On episode 2 of No Notes, I was joined by the wonderful Princess of Darkness herself, former CEO of the Oakland/Los Angeles Raiders and now of CBS Sports, Amy Trask. Hope you guys enjoy. This is a lot of fun to do. So without further ado, here is Amy. All right. Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 2 of No Notes, the show with no research, just people talking. Jarrett Bailey, joined by the amazing, wonderful Princess of Darkness, Amy Trask. This is, you know, when I first started the idea of wanting to do this show, you were one of the first people I was like, I need to get her on because I feel like she's just got a lot to tell. And I think it would be a lot of fun. So thank you for doing this, Amy. How are you?
I am well, and thank you for inviting me to join you. It's my honor and my pleasure, and I have a sneaky little suspicion it's going to be a whole lot of fun.
I hope so. I hope so. When I wanted to do this, I figured it would be. So there's so much that I could pick your brain about and talk to you about, but I will start with this. A few weeks ago, you took away the ability for me to ever win an argument with Leanne Mooney ever again in my life about ice cream toppings. So I have a bone to pick with you, first of all.
Well, you know, the girl in me who went to law school is kind of proud that I set forth an argument which was as compelling as it seems to have been. But please do tell me how it was that I succeeded at doing that to defeat your argument from this point forward.
Yeah, so the girl that I am currently talking to, anytime like people come together and start trying to get to know one another, like there's a lot of just like, I don't want to say meaningless, but like just little conversations. And she had asked me like, what's like one random thing that like I just really don't like? And I said, yeah, I just don't like sprinkles. I think sprinkles on ice cream is terrible. I just do not like it. And so it just became like a funny like little inside joke. And then, you and I talked about it on Twitter, and then it just became a thing where I had told her, oh, by the way, you know, Amy, you may not know who Amy Trask is, but I bet your father does. She definitely just helped you win the sprinkle debate. So kudos to her.
You know, the fact that you said that about sprinkles and she didn't immediately stand up, walk out and say, done, you know, speaks highly of you. There's obviously something that compelled her to continue the conversation after that sprinkle blasphemy. But look, all teasing aside, there's a great saying that the daughter of one of my dearest friends taught me. She learned it as a young child. Don't yick someone else's yum or don't yuck someone else's yum. I don't remember whether it's yick or yum, but if someone likes something and you don't yick or don't yuck their yum. So just back off the sprinkles, okay? Don't yick my yum. And I won't yick your yum.
That's fair. Yeah. I mean, as somebody who is an avid pro wrestling fan, I've gotten my fair share of people yicking my yum. So, you know what? Maybe I should take a little bit of my own advice on that.
Well, I won't yick your yum right now on the wrestling.
Okay, thank you. I genuinely appreciate it.
I'll just think it.
all right, so before we stop talking, do you like mint chocolate chip ice cream, by the way? Because that's another one that I'm just not in on.
You know, I have a wide, wide, wide variety of favorite flavors. Okay. I like flavors that have bits and pieces, lumps and bumps, swirls and twirls, nuggets and chips. So yeah, I like a chip ice cream. I like mint chip and vanilla chip and chocolate chip and coffee chip, mocha chip. I like ice cream that has things in it. Now, wherever I to sit down with ice cream that doesn't have anything in it, I would dump things in it because I like there to be things in my ice cream.
I think I just might be a little bit of the opposite. Like I like a good soft serve. I'm a very okay, like I like vanilla soft serve. I'll be more than happy with that. Strawberry.
We have not yet found our happy meeting place on food. We just haven't found our happy meeting place yet.
I like strawberry. Ice cream, do you like strawberry?
If it has things in it or on it. So, you know, strawberry with chips in it, with sprinkles on it. I like things in my ice cream and on my ice cream. By the way, I'm getting hungry just having this conversation.
Yeah, I know. I promise we'll move on here momentarily. My favorite is cookie dough ice cream, which has, you know, the bits of cookie dough in it. So I think, is that a happy meeting place that we can end the ice cream conversation on? Is that
we like cookie dough
ice cream? We
can. And by the way, that is one of my husband's favorite flavors as well. So you and he are of like mind on that. So we always have that in the house as well.
Lovely, lovely. So being, you know, the fact that you are, and not to say this just because you're here, I mean, you were genuinely a pioneer for women in the sports industry. With that, I mean, does that come with any sort of, I don't want to say pressure, but what was it like for you? Why football, first of all? Like, has it always been football for you? Has it always just been, you know, I want to do this and damn to anybody who tries to stop me from doing it?
There's a lot of answers to that. And I'm going to go to the last part of your question first, having nothing to do with my career, or maybe everything to do with my career, but really everything to do with my life. The best way to get me to do anything is to tell me not to do it. You want me to do something, tell me I can't do it, I shouldn't do it, I'm not supposed to do it, and I'm going to do it. Now, that did not happen with my career. I fell in love with the game of football when I was in junior high. Now, back in the day, when I went to junior high was 7th through 9th grade. 7th grade, I went to my first ever football game. It was at junior high, and I just loved the game. You know, we think of it as a game of speed and strength and power, and it is, but it's also a very cerebral game. It's a game of matchups. Can my pass protection stop your pass rush? Can my pass rush get to your quarterback? Can my corners cover your receivers? Can my linebackers stay with your running backs? It's a game of matchups. It's cerebral. It's a game of strategy. And yes, you know what it is? It's a game of chess with very powerful, strong, fast chess pieces. Fell in love with the game of football. And I grew up in a family, you know, everybody watched the Super Bowl. My parents would either have a Super Bowl party or we'd all go to a Super Bowl party at someone's house. But they were never home on Sundays watching football. The whole family was out doing something. And I was the kid that wanted to stay home after junior high from that point on and watch football.
You know, I think that you and I kind of share a little bit of, you know, being home Sundays. And I'm going to admit, every place that I've worked since, like, being like high school and college or whatnot, like, you know, when I was in school, if I needed a little extra money and I would take a job, I would always lie and think of an excuse of why I couldn't work Sundays solely for the purpose that I could be home and, you know, do my side writing stuff or be able to watch the games and be able to, you know, just try to do anything I could not to be at work on Sundays. So I applaud that level of, no, let's stay home and watch football, damn it.
Well, and, you know, growing up in LA, I didn't have a favorite team down here. For the holidays, I'd always, you know, from sort of high school, that age, at the holidays, I'd buy my dad, you know, tickets to a game, ticket to a Rams game, mostly because then I'd buy two tickets and we'd go together. And it was a fun, fun time with my dad. But I fell in love with the Raiders when I was in college at Berkeley. The Raiders were in Oakland at the time. Al had not yet moved the team to Los Angeles. You know, we often say it's just down the road. Well, the Raiders really were just down the road from Berkeley. And I fell in love with everything about the team. You know, you'd watch NFL on television and you'd see visiting teams coming up to the stadium on game day and they'd get out of the bus and they were wearing coats or coats and ties and carrying briefcases. And then you'd see the Raider bus roll up to the stadium and the door of the bus would open and they'd just tumble out of the bus looking like the cat dragged them in the night before. There was no coat. There was no briefcase. I mean, they stumbled their way in and then they won. And I love that about the team. And, you know, more importantly, or what really resonated with me was the team was owned by a man, Al Davis, who gave people second chances and third chances. And in some instances, more chances than people said he should have given others. Well, oh, and he didn't care if you were labeled a behavior problem. And having been labeled a behavior problem in kindergarten and having had that label stick with me all the way through high school, and some people say it still is appropriate, it resonated with me that he didn't care if someone else called you a behavior problem. And it resonated with me that he gave people second chances and third chances because I'd been given second and third chances.
Stumbling out of the bus and winning. I don't think that there's a better phrase that personifies that era of Raiders football than that. That's I remember seeing an NFL Films interview with Ken Stabler, and he would say that he would study the playbook by the light of the jukebox. And he'd say, how much sleep do you need if you're going to go play a game for 3 hours? Like, who cares? And I love that.
And those comments that Ken made, or whether it was Freddie Biletnikoff or Ted Hendricks or all these men I had the just tremendous fortune of getting to spend time with and watch games with throughout my career, those weren't adages that they threw out for attention. They really believed those things. I mean, those were the men who played the game as we've just been discussing. They stumbled out of the bus and they won. And they were tremendous, tremendous men. Gene Upshaw, Art Shaw. I mean, Gene will forever have, you know, maybe the hugest spot in my heart of any Raider.
In terms of all the players that you've gotten, you know, to work with throughout your career, is there a specific maybe year or a specific group of players that kind of stick out to you? That was just a fantastic group that kind of, you know, sticks out amongst the rest.
All the men that I just named played before I was with the organization. Mm-hmm. But one thing Al did was kept players close. If you were a part of that, you know, you didn't play and then leave and you were gone. I mean, those players right. that I just named, men in the Hall of Fame, players at every position, players, whether they were starters or they had a lesser role, they were around the organization all the time. I saw them at training camp. I saw them on game day. I saw them at home and on the road. They were in our offices, just tremendous men.
Right.
I do have one favorite player. I have never said his name. I will never say his name.
I was about to get like an inside scoop here.
You're not getting it. I'll be happy to share the story as to why he's a favorite player. Nobody's probably ever heard of him before. But thanks to him, I kept my job. It was very, very, very early in my career. I mean, the first couple weeks or so. And someone in our pro personnel department comes running into my office with this player contract, which, as you know, are collectively bargained. They're, you know, form contracts where you could adjust certain things. And he's waving it at me and he says, I need you to supersede this. I need you to supersede this. And I said, supersede what? And he points to this whole, you know, just drags his hand down over all these paragraphs and says, supersede this. So I wrote the best damn supersede clause you have ever, ever seen. And they sign the contract and everything goes on. Well, that night, it's after midnight, phone rings. It's the first after midnight call I ever got from Al, one of, you know, hundreds to follow. And he explains to me in a very calm, but kind of not so calm, but no, it was calm. It was just strong. It was stern. That's the word. It was calm, but stern voice, that in drafting that provision, I had turned the contract, which was for a player who was going to be, you know, the 53rd man on the roster mm-hmm. or right around there. I had turned it into a guaranteed no cut, no trade contract. He went on to tell me that the player had agreed to rip the contract up to meet me in the office the next morning before his 5 or 6 a.m. flight out of town. So I went back to the office. I got there by 3 or 4 in the morning. I don't even remember what time it was. And I had a new contract ready to go. And the player ripped up his old one in front of me. He signed the new one. And because he did that, I still had a job. So that is my favorite player.
That is maybe one of the craziest stories I've heard from anybody in the NFL business. That's fascinating. First of all, just the sheer balls of that guy to be like, all right, do this. Let's see if I can get away with this. And then Al to be like, hey.
Oh, no. It wasn't the play. It was our personnel guy. He didn't understand.
Okay.
The player personnel guy was asking me to supersede one little paragraph.
Okay.
But he pointed to the whole side of the paper and he said, supersede all of this. So I did. And I was, that was a damn good supersede provision. It was absolutely an accident. And the player didn't have to rip up his contract, but he was very gracious, very kind. And he did. And he saved my job.
Well, whomever that player is,
my favorite.
Bless his heart.
Exactly.
So what year did you join the Raiders? This is no notes. This is no research.
I love no nuts. I actually just said on your podcast, no nuts. But Oh my gosh, is that going to go viral, as the kids would say?
I hope so. I would love for that to go viral.
I love no notes. Notes, that's what I meant to say. I started my internship with a team in 83. I was an intern in the 83-85 timeframe. And then I left. I graduated from grad school. I was an intern during grad school. Graduated, took a job because there was nothing available at the Raiders. And then about a year and a half later, maybe a little less, give or take, in 1987, I joined the team full time.
Okay. So I'm sure that you have a plethora of different Al Davis stories, and we're going to get to, you know, maybe a few of them, because in terms of the people that are on the NFL Mount Rushmore, Al is definitely one of them. But so you come on in 87, you say. Okay. So you were there kind of in the midst of the Bo Jackson craze then. Was that what you were? Did you have a front row seat for that?
Bo was with us when I was with the team, yes.
So how was that, by the way? Because many consider Bo the greatest athlete to ever walk this planet, and you got to see firsthand just what he was capable of. What was it? Just take me through what it was like. I didn't have the pleasure of being alive to watch Bo at the, you know, when he was playing. So try to paint a picture.
You have no idea how much I want to hang this phone up right now. I'm having a conversation with someone who just told me that he was not alive at the outset of my career.
I was born in 98.
I just want to sit here maybe and cry.
I'm
teasing. I don't want to cry. But you know that that gif of the woman who, and I use it a lot on Twitter, but it's the woman who's sitting and sobbing and just shoveling ice cream in her face, like straight out of the carton. You just told me when you were born, and I want to be that woman right now, just sitting here crying and shoveling ice cream in my face. Did you hear that, everyone who's listening? He just pointed out to me when he was born, which was after over a decade after I started my career with the Raiders. it would be kind of funny if I just hung up, wouldn't it?
That would be something, wouldn't it? Like me just, you know, laughing and then quickly panicking.
Okay. So Bo, you know, just a magnificent athlete, as you indicated. There really is no way I can describe. He just special, I guess that's the word I use, just special. You know, I remember we were up in Seattle. That's when they played in the Kingdom. Yeah. And he just ran over Brian Bosworth, like I might run on my way to get ice cream out of the freezer. And, you know, I might run over, you know, a napkin and knock it down the way he knocked Bosworth over. And then, you know, there were just other games as well where he would do things, and we meaning the staff on the team, when we were watching the game together, we would just look at one another like, how did he do that? And, you know, I remember vividly remember the game in which he had his not career ending injury, because he continued to play baseball, but his football ending injury. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it didn't look like a horrible injury when it happened. He was tackled by the leg. The defender pulled his leg and his body twisted. But you looked at it and you didn't think, oh, wow. It just wasn't one of those hits where you hit, or one of those tackles, I should say, where you held your breath. But after the game, my brother and sister-in-law were there, and they're both doctors. And my sister-in-law said to me, you guys better worry about avascular necrosis. And I looked at her, I'm like, oh, he's going to be fine. So the next day and the next day and the next day in the office, as we're working through the injury, I say to Al, you know, we have to look into something called avascular necrosis. And, you know, our trainer looked at me like I was nuts. Our doctors looked at me like I was nuts. This is the day after the game or 2 days after the game. Well, sure enough, that's exactly what doomed his career, what my sister-in-law diagnosed from the stands.
Watching that, like, obviously I didn't see it live, but like watching it back, yeah, like with the hip, you know, you didn't really see anything there that was like, oh, you know, it wasn't anything to the eye that said, okay, this could be serious.
Well, not to your eye, not to my eye.
Yeah. Apparently to doctor's eyes.
Certainly to my sister-in-law's eye.
I think that in a way, it kind of adds to the legend of Bo that he went out without having any sort of decline. Like, we hear all these stories about just his athletic feats. And I think that with that, you know, not being him going out, even if it wasn't on his own terms in terms of football, but we don't have, you know, that those video clips or memories of Bo, you know, not being Bo Jackson.
It's interesting. I've never looked at it that way. That's definitely a very interesting perspective, because you're right. Anytime anyone sees a clip of Bo playing football, it's a wow clip.
You know, the old commercial, Bo knows, like, I genuinely believe that if he wanted to, like, be the world's best cricket player, if you gave him like a couple years to train, he probably could have done it.
Yep.
And in terms of anybody that I wish I could have seen in their prime, he is absolutely at the top of my list. A lot of guys in that era too. I mean, Deion Sanders is very similar. Just both of those guys were just crossover stars that were fantastic. And I feel like I was born in the wrong era when it comes to stuff like that. I really think I missed out.
Deion, magnificent, magnificent. You know, I remember we played a game and it was a pivotal, pivotal game for us with respect to playoffs. And, you know, we were playing Deion and I sort of assumed we wouldn't throw at his side of the field. Well, our coach had other ideas and thought, ha, 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 I'll show them. I'll show that team. I'll show them. I'm going to throw right at Deion. That didn't work out so well. And then I remember a game we played in Dallas, and we, towards the end of the game, and we had the lead, and we had to punt, and Deion's back there, and you know, all everyone's thinking is the only thing you don't do is you don't punt to Deion. You just don't do that. You know, put it out of bounds, put it here, put it there, punt it straight to him, and he's running it back, and it just has every appearance that he's going to score, and then we would lose the game. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, one of our linebackers just comes flying on an angle across the field, catches him from behind, brings him down, seals the victory for us. And the reason I share that is the look on Deion's face when he stood up and looked at that linebacker like, who the hell are you and how did you do that? But you're absolutely right. Just another transcendent athlete.
Well, I promise I do have good Raider memories. So I don't know if you can see it, but over my shoulder, I do have a picture of the Immaculate Reception. I'm a Steeler fan. Let me you know, negate that to start.
Okay, so far during our conversation, you told me that you weren't alive a decade into my career, and you've now told me that you're a Steeler fan, and we're going to talk about the Immaculate Reception. I'm staying on this call. Why?
No. I promise it's not about the Immaculate Reception. I just wanted to point out that it was there. So my grandfather was actually a very large Raiders fan, and he lived in Hawaii when I was pretty young. He came up, one of the times he came up to visit, the Steelers played the Raiders that week. It was 2006. It was the year after Pittsburgh won the Super Bowl, and they would go 8-8 that season. It was the year after Ben had his motorcycle accident, and it was Bill Cowher's last year. And they went to Oakland, and Ben threw four interceptions that day, and the Raiders absolutely destroyed Pittsburgh. And my grandfather, God rest his soul, gave me hell the entire afternoon. So I've got a nice little sweet memory of my grandpa just making fun of little 8-year-old me as I'm just sitting there bewildered watching the Raiders kick Ben Roethlisberger's ass for 3 hours. So that's my nice Raiders memory.
Well, three comments with respect to that story. One, nice of you to drop in that you were 8 years old. I'm doing the math again. Two, I remember that game very, very, very well.
Do
and
you?
I do. And three, I like your grandfather, and I recognize he's not with us anymore, but I think your grandfather and I could have been friends.
He was
giving you a little heck.
Yeah. I mean, like when I was really young, like I think I've known from a pretty young age that this is kind of what I wanted to do is, you know, talk about football, write about football, and just kind of make this my livelihood. And he was, I didn't get to see him too much because, like I said, he lived in Hawaii. But this is always something that my father and I have shared is just a love for the game. But whenever he would come up and he came up during the fall, that was always something that we'd really bond over. And that was one of the first times that I vividly remember him being there for a game and just him laughing every time Ben threw a pick. And I'm just like, it's fourth one. Like, in my head, I'm like, what the hell is happening? First of all,
I already love your grandfather, not only because he's a Raiders fan, but because he was giving you crap.
Oh, yeah.
Also, because he lived in Hawaii. I mean, I really think me and Grandpa could have been pals. You know, you're a Steeler fan, so I will tell you something very, very special about the Steelers because, yes, on-field rivals, but, you know, when you're in part of the National Football League, on game day, you're rivals. On the field, you're rivals. But at all other times, you're business partners and your colleagues. And, you know, I'm joking around, kind of crying, joking, eating my ice cream as we talk and teasing you about my age. But when I started my career with the Raiders, again, I was an intern in 83 through 85. I started full time in 87. The topics we're discussing today about women in sports, women in business, women in leadership positions in business, in sports, those weren't conversations that were going on then. Those weren't topics back then. So I walk into my first ever NFL owners meeting. I'm the only woman in the room. I'm told at the time that other than the wives or children, daughters of team owners, it's the first time a woman has ever been in the room. And one of the first people to extend himself to me and immediately offer me his support and in his encouragement was Dan Rooney. And what makes that even more special than simply the fact that he did that, when I joined the Raiders and the league were already in litigation. Mm-hmm. And I would be remiss if I didn't turn into my five-year-old self and point out that they started it. We were the defendant. And I will never talk about that litigation without quickly turning into a five-year-old and saying they started it, but we were a defendant because they started it, but we were in litigation, Al versus all the other owners. Mm-hmm. So Dan Rooney, putting aside the fact that I'm the only woman in the room, he had every reason to be annoyed at everyone that worked for the Raiders. But I will never forget at my first meeting him extending a welcome and offering me his support and his encouragement. And he did that for decades. So that's my love for the Steelers story.
I absolutely love that. Everything about it. I feel like that's a pretty good segue into talking about Al. Because as I said, I mean, in terms of people who are, you know, responsible for the foundation of the league, I mean, he's definitely among them. So tell me a little bit about how he went into the process of bringing you on to begin with, because as you said, I mean, there wasn't in these conversations about women in sports, much less as high a role as you held. How did that even come to be to begin with?
Well, I started as an intern, and he was not the one who brought me aboard as an intern. He wasn't hiring interns, bringing interns on. But during my internship, I had the opportunity to interact with him on some projects I worked on that had been assigned to me, and I worked on them, but they touched on areas that involved him. So I interacted with him when I was an intern. I also would interact with him if I saw him in the building or something like that. I didn't work with him a lot. I didn't work with him often, but I did interact with him. When I left the Raiders after my internship, as I mentioned, there were no opportunities for me at that time. But I graduated in 85 and I joined I finished my internship in 85 and I joined the team full time in 87. So whatever gap of time that was, I had another job and someone at the Raiders went to Al and said, I want to hire someone else. And he said, okay, go ahead, do it. And the gentleman said, and I'd like to hire Amy. And Al said, oh, right. She was the one that was the intern. And he said, yeah, and they hired me. So, yes, he gave the thumbs up on hiring me. Yes, he knew who I was from my internship, but he's not the one who initially hired me as an intern. He did have to approve my hiring on a full-time basis, which he did.
So where did that relationship go from there? How quickly did it become, you know, this kind of legendary in Raiders history, you know, partnership between you and Al, you know, being a top of that franchise for so long?
Well, first of all, the biggest misconception about Al is that he wouldn't tolerate anyone who disagreed with him, or he wouldn't tolerate disagreement. If that were the case, I'd have been fired 2 weeks into my job. I was in a room. He walked in. I was sitting with a colleague. He just lit into this guy. I mean, just ripped into him like you can imagine a velociraptor ripping into flesh. And after listening to him for a little while, I realized he was wrong. So he was talking very loudly. I mean, I don't know if you'd call it yelling or hollering, but very loudly. So in a very loud voice, because I don't have a dainty voice anyway, but I had to talk loudly to be heard. I said, "Excuse me, you're wrong." And oh my gosh, I will never forget the look on his head, on his face, when he turned his head 90 degrees to look at me, maybe a little less than 90 degrees. And I went on and I said, "You're wrong." And I said, "If the facts on which you were basing your conclusion were accurate, it would be a fair conclusion. In other words, if you had accurate data, accurate information, and that's how you were reaching this conclusion, fair enough. But you're basing your decision on inaccurate information and you're wrong." Well, he yelled and I yelled and he yelled and I yelled. And I learned quite a while later that people had gathered, everyone in the whole area of the building, of the organization, had gathered in the hallway to listen. Because, you know, here's this girl who's been with the team on a full-time basis for like 2 weeks, having a shouting match with Al, screaming at him that he's wrong. One woman even brought cartons to pack boxes because she figured I'd have to leave. So she brought me cartons to pack my stuff in these boxes. But quite a while later, I mean, we argued for a while. It wasn't quick. And after we argued for a while, he looked at me and he said, "Okay, I gotcha. I got it. And we went on to finish the conversation in a very productive manner. And I learned at that moment, everybody who said you can't disagree with Al is wrong. Everyone who said he wouldn't tolerate people who disagreed with him was wrong. But I also know, and this is my rule in general, if you're going to disagree with someone, don't disagree just for the sake of being disagreeable. Have some reasons, have some information, have some, you know, arguments to make. And I will tell you that over the course of the almost 30 years I was with the organization, we disagreed more than we agreed."
Really? I find that fascinating.
We worked together. And look, at the end of the day, I recognize this is the man who owns the majority interest in this business. Mm-hmm. He is the controlling owner. So I'm going to disagree with him and I'm going to tell him when I think he's wrong and I'm going to tell him when I think he's making a bad decision. But ultimately, if he makes the decision, even if it's a decision with which I disagree, it's my job to implement it as best I can.
Was there a disagreement anytime in maybe like the war room of different draft days that maybe, you know, after a pick was announced, you're like, "Ah, what in the hell was that?"
Well, I was not in the draft room.
Okay.
So my responsibilities on draft day involved taking care of our Raider limited partners. In other words, partners, people who owned an interest in the Raiders, but were not the controlling owners. Mm-hmm. I was with them. I was with our sponsors. We had fan events. We had youth events. We had community events. We had business partners there, sponsors we wanted to attract. So I had business responsibilities. I was not in the draft room, but I do vividly recall the time where we were getting killed in the weeks leading up to the draft, because it was anticipated that we were going to draft a certain player that everybody deemed, you know, just an absurd draft choice, dumb, absurd, mm-hmm. bad. So I remember I was downstairs with our sponsors, our prospective sponsors, our partners, all of that. And someone looks for me and says, "You got to call Al." So I go to one of the phones in the building and Al wants to talk to you. You got to talk to Al right now. So I reach him in the draft room, or he reaches me downstairs, and he says these words: "We're going to take them. We're going to get killed for it. You're going to have to handle it. Click." So that was a draft day story for you.
I love just the visual of you like, "Hello. Yeah, I'm taking him. Good luck."
Yeah, exactly. "You're going to have to handle it. Click."
You know what? And I think that that's something to be said about just the not give a crappery of Al Davis. It's like, you know what? Oh. I think that I've been in this business long enough to deal with this. If this is a guy I want, I'm going to do it. To hell with what everybody else thinks.
Well, and taking that, extrapolating that viewpoint of, you know, not giving a damn what anyone says mm-hmm. to beyond the draft, I owe my career to him and I owe my career to that. Mm-hmm. Look, going back to the day and age when I was hired, look, there's going to be people listening to this who are Raider fans and people who hate the Raiders. There will be people listening to this who loved Al and people who couldn't stand him. But if we're all being intellectually honest, whether you like the man or you didn't, whether you love the team or you don't, this is someone who hired without regard to race, gender, or any other individuality, which has no bearing on whether one can do a job, decades before that was even a conversation. So his willingness to be a contrarian, and to do what he thought was the right thing to do, irrespective of what others thought, well, that I owe that, I owe my career to him. And by the way, I'm a contrarian too, so maybe that's why we got along.
And I think that's an important distinction to make as well, because not only did he go out of his way for, you know, women in sports, but also, you know, people of color in that era, or probably the era before that, but, you know, in the 70s and whatnot, paving ways for, you know, different people, different ethnicities. And I think in a lot of ways, Al was a pioneer in the regard.
Absolutely. And I'll do this chronologically, not in order of importance, because I'd put myself last if it was order of importance. But chronologically, he hires Tom Flores. Mm-hmm. He hires me. He hires Art Shell. And he wanted no credit for any of this. I remember saying to him any number of times that what he had done in that regard, hiring in the manner he did without regard to race or gender or ethnicity or any of those individualities I've referenced, which have no bearing on whether one can do a job, he deserved acknowledgement for that and credit. And he would shut me down every time and say, hey, I don't want any credit for it. I don't want any acknowledgement for it. In other words, he did it because it was the right thing to do.
What does it mean to you to see, you know, while we still have a ways to go in this, how far that, you know, the sports world has come? Because now, I mean, in the NFL alone, we've got multiple women assistant coaches. We've got multiple women referees, multiple women front office personnel. What's that mean to you, seeing how far that has come? But also what we still have to do to keep making progress?
Well, you stated that perfectly in both regards. We have come quite a ways. And we still have a lot more to do in every regard, whether it's gender or any of the other things we've discussed. I'm asked all the time when a woman is hired in the NFL or in sports as a whole, or when she's advanced, am I excited? And the answer is sure. But what's going to really excite me is when these things are no longer newsworthy, when it's no longer newsworthy that someone is getting a job irrespective of race or gender or any of these individualities. That's what's going to be really exciting. So are the advances exciting? Of course. But what's going to be really exciting is when they're no longer newsworthy.
I think that is as perfectly stated as that could have possibly been. I like to consider myself an advocate for women in sports. You know, there's a ton of women who are coming up with me that, you know, are around my age trying to find their way in this, and seeing them get those opportunities means a lot. You know, just knowing that a long time ago, they may not have gotten these opportunities.
You know, that game where you either say bingo or you say drink every time you reference age, do I get to say drink? Or
I'm not trying to reference age, Amy. I promise.
I know you're not. And I hope you know I'm teasing you in good fun. I'm not in the slightest bit offended or bothered, but I am having fun teasing you. And I am keeping count, by the way.
That's fine. I think that's three times.
Are we three. On the same good, count? Good, okay. Good job good. Counting. That's three. By the way, I don't take offense. I really just don't take offense. It would be very hard to work for Al for almost 30 years and take offense at anything.
But yes, this is, I think it's important for that, I don't even know the word for it, that group of people, that era of the people who are saying, you know, women don't belong in sports. Like, I think that we're slowly but surely seeing that kind of die out. There's still a very loud vocal minority of those people. But I do think that the progress that we are seeing is definitely, it is good. And I think that there's more good than bad.
I had the pleasure of interviewing Sarah Thomas recently. And by the way, that was my first ever interview, other than interviewing people for the job, for jobs. That was the first time I ever interviewed anyone on television. And of all people, I had the honor of doing that with Sarah Thomas. And I shared with her the following that I will now share with you. Leading up to the Super Bowl that she officiated, umpteen people said to me, well, you know, the league is just, you know, putting her on the field. They've named her an official just to check a box, just for, you know, publicity, just for correctness. The league's just doing it, you know, for those reasons. Mm-hmm. And I looked at them and I said, you are just nuts. That is a nutty thing to say. I sat in league owners' meetings for almost 30 years, and I will assure you that the only thing the league wants from the officiating in the Super Bowl is for officiating not to be a topic after the Super Bowl. The only thing the league wants are the best officials on the field for that game. They did not put Sarah Thomas on the field for brownie points. They put Sarah Thomas on the field because she graded out and earned that job.
How long is she? I don't know the exact time. I know that she was brought on, I think, the late 2010s. I don't remember the exact year, but I know that she was among
You know, I don't remember the year either right now off the top of my head. Maybe 2017, 16, 18.
Right.
And the reason I did, Peter King gave me the great, great honor of writing a piece on her for his MMQB. And I wrote, and so I think it was about that time.
And we've seen more come in since then. And like I said, multiple women coaches have made their way into the league, which is great to see. Do you think that we're ever going to, and if how soon do you think that we'll maybe see, you know, maybe a female offensive coordinator, running back coach, position coach of anything of that sort, where they're like a main, you know, coordinator holding a job like that on an NFL team?
Will we see it? I think we will. Mm-hmm. When will we see it? I don't know the answer to that. Look, you know as well as I do that you don't just wake up one day and say, I'm going to be a head coach.
Right.
Or I'm going to be, or you don't wake up and say, I'm going to be a head coach now. I'm going to be a CEO now. I'm going to be, you know, you work your way into those positions. And similarly, you work your way into the position of offensive coordinator, defensive coordinator, special teams coordinator. You have to start at the bottom. And right now, a lot of teams have started pipelines to give people an opportunity to work their way into those positions. So, and that's terrific because that's the only way you're going to end up being an OC or a DC or a special teams coordinator is working your way into that position. And ultimately, that's how head coaches earn their positions as well. So those pipelines do now exist.
I think we've seen a really good example outside of football, but in the NBA with Greg Popovich hiring Becky Hammon as one of his top assistants and her being the head G League or the summer league coach. And really just making her a name for herself in NBA coaching. I think Pop himself is a big pioneer, similar to Al, where he doesn't care about, you know, he doesn't look at race, ethnicity, gender, whatever it is. He wants the best person for the job. And I think that having Becky there with him was just the match made in heaven, especially for her to advance in her career.
I think the world of Popovich, I think what he did with respect to Becky is terrific. And also, I was wrong on Sarah now that I think about it. This is how my brain works. Sometimes no notes, right? We have no
exactly,
notes.
Exactly.
It was 2013. It was either, yeah, I think it was 2013.
Oh, it was that early? Okay, I thought
Yeah, and you, do you want to know how I figured it out? Nah, that's not important. Because I remembered where I was when I wrote the piece. And for it to for me to be where I was where I wrote the piece, it had to be 2013.
Okay.
What do we call that? Was that inductive reasoning or deductive reasoning? I don't know which, but it was 2013.
Yeah, no, I was a journalism major, but I've never, those are two words that I've never understood the influx of. So we'll go with one of them.
Okay, that's fair enough.
But yeah, no, I think Becky and Pop, I think that's one of the better modern examples of, you know, a guy just going out of his way to make sure that somebody who was deserving of a job, it didn't matter that she was a woman. He made sure that, you know, she got that.
You know, the story I use when you just mentioned the word deserving of a job. And the story I always share with people when they question whether certain people should have jobs or not have jobs, Apollo 13 is my favorite movie. And when, you know, Apollo 13 is up in space, or I don't know what you call it, space or inner space or outer space or wherever Apollo 13 was, and I'm embarrassed that I'm blanking on that right now. And there's a problem with Apollo 13. And there's a scene in the movie where the character played by Ed Harris walks into a room at NASA, and there's a group of people assembled around the table. And he dumps onto the table just this bucket of bolts and nuts and nuts and bolts and pieces and parts. And he says, using only these pieces and parts, because this is the only pieces and parts they have with them on Apollo 13, find a way to get them home safely. Do you think anyone sitting on Apollo 13 gave a damn what the race or religion or gender or ethnicity or any individuality of those people sitting around the table was? They just wanted to get home alive. And that's the way we should evaluate filling jobs. Are you qualified?
Just win, baby.
I see what you did there.
I felt if there was any place I could sneak that in there, that was a pretty damn good one.
Well done.
Thank you. We were talking about movies. I talked about movies on the first episode of this with Sean Ross Sapp, and his movie choice was a little bit different than mine. But my favorite movie of all time is Halloween. I don't know how you feel about horror movies, but they're my bread and butter. What about you?
I like them. I don't have an aversion to them. I'm not I don't want to see a horror movie. So I like them. They're not my favorite. As I said, Apollo 13 is my favorite. Also up there on my favorite list, Animal House. But the scariest movie I ever saw, this predates you, the scariest movie I ever saw was the original Omen.
Oh, that's a fantastic movie.
The original one scared me to pieces. And I remember the night that I saw it, and then I had to drive my girlfriend home. And then I drove back to our home. You know, I was living with my parents. And you know, I was a kid. I probably just had gotten my driver's license, parked the car, walk in the house. And my dad calls me into the den and says, you know, come say goodnight to me. And he had written 666 behind his ear. I ran to my bedroom. I pulled the dresser out. I put the dresser in front of the door. I mean, I would not come out of that room till my mom got home from work.
I think I'm going to, when I put this out as the podcast, I think I'm going to name the episode Amy Trask is Horrified of the Omen. I think that's a pretty good one.
It's the scariest movie I've ever seen.
I think the Blair Witch Project's the scariest movie I've ever seen. I can't watch that in like sleep sound at night ever. That movie's horrifying.
You want my Blair, before we go, you want my Blair Witch Project story?
Oh, I would love it.
We're in Denver to play the Broncos on the road in Denver. And I could never, ever, ever sleep the night before games. Well, for this particular game, I decided I would rent a movie. I did that a lot. You know, it's the night before the game. I know I'm not going to sleep. I decide I'm going to rent a movie. So I should say, for this particular game, I decide I'm going to rent some rom-com or some lighthearted rom-com movie. Well, I pressed the wrong button on the remote control, and the Blair Witch Project comes on. Well, I figured, all right, I'm already paying like $9 for this. I'm not going to change the movie. Of all the dumb things to do when you're in a hotel room on the road and you know you're not going to sleep anyway, so even any chance of a 5-minute nod off, I watched the Blair Witch Project the night before we played the Broncos. I was so scared. I reverted to what I just told you I did when I was like a 15 or 16-year-old. I grabbed the dresser and pulled it in front of the hotel door. Like a dresser's really going to keep a spirit out, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, God knows that the thing to ward off a ghost is furniture.
Yeah. How is pulling a dresser in front of the door when I was a kid or pulling a dresser in front of the door in a hotel when we're on the road to play the Broncos going to save me from an evil spirit? They could just like slip in through the cracks.
That's a lovely story. I will say this about before I let you go. Raiders fans are unlike any fan base that I've ever come across. And they came after me last year, and I'll tell you that story real quick. So I do a yearly thing before the season starts. I'll go game by game, predict every game, release them, have everybody, you know, tell me I suck on Twitter or whatever. Raiders fans, I was scared that one of them was going to come to my house and just rip me a new one. Say what you want about any other fan base. Raiders fans, when they find somebody they don't like, they rally like it's 300 and they're the Spartans just ready to attack. Oh my good. I was public enemy number one to Raiders fans for a solid week and a half. I had never seen anything like it. So the Raiders fans have my respect.
Well, the giggling that you heard as you started your story, I was not giggling at the fact that you know, give your predictions because I enjoy looking at your predictions. I was giggling as I saw where this story was going. Raider fans, I love them. I cherish my relationship with Raider fans. I cherished it while I was with the team. I still cherish my relationship with the fans. I will forever have the backs of the fans. I will tell you a quick story, which is the nickname Princess of Darkness. Mm-hmm. I got that name because Mike Silver, writing for Sports Illustrated at the time, mm-hmm. wrote a feature. And in it, he quoted several league or club, I don't remember if they were team executives or league executives or team owners, off the record, saying behind her back, we call her the Princess of Darkness. And they were off the record, and it was very, very, very clear from the story. It was not intended as a compliment. Right. We call her the Princess of Darkness behind her back. That was not a compliment. Well, Raider fans embrace that name. I embrace that name, and I will forever cherish that nickname, which in my view is the best nickname in the world. And it comes from Raider fans. And you know what? I'll leave you with this thought on fans. There is no National Football League without the fans. And I recognize the importance of fans from the time I started my career as an intern. Fans should be cherished. Fans should be thanked. Fans should be appreciated. And by appreciated, I don't just mean with like a little hat at the end of the season or a little water bottle at the end of the season. You got to cherish fans because there is no league without fans. And yes, I do still love Raider fans. I always will. I kind of like that they came after you.
I wouldn't expect anything less from the Black Hole and all of Raider Nation. Amy, this has been an absolute joy, a pleasure. I can't thank you enough for doing this. Is there anything that you would like to plug before we go? I know that the Big Three stuff is starting to, you know, become hot again. Is there anything you want to talk about with that?
Well, we are in the Big Three season. We just had week one. We're starting week two. For those who don't know, it's a 3-on-3 basketball league founded by Ice Cube and his longtime business partner, Jeff Quantnitz. Our commissioner is Clyde the Glide Drexler. And it's just a magnificent, magnificent league. We are in our fifth season. We would have had another season under our belt, but we had to do a full hard shutdown for the pandemic. We came back. And we're getting ready for another season.
Well, I can't wait to tune in for it. Again, thank you so much for doing this. This is an absolute blast, an honor for me to do. I promise no more age comments. We can stop them at 3.
And I just want you to know, I don't know if you're still recording this for the podcast or not. I hope that you feel free to use this. I was